I was canoeing in the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, and I met these dwarves. For those of you who don't know this, there's this vast area not too far away from us in southern New Jersey called the Pine Barrens. It's just vast acres and acres of pine coniferous forest in sandy territory, and it's crisscrossed by these canals. That's why you can canoe in there. I was canoeing through this and really struck because I met these dwarves, and I had a hard time understanding them as I was talking to them. It was really difficult. And it was one of the most eerie experiences that I've had, you know, this landscape. It was just a really mysterious, eerie landscape, and to be coming into this situation and then meeting these people I couldn't really talk to too well. It kind of reinforced this idea that I was kind of paddling through a fairy tale in some way. And I later, you know, read that this area of the country had people who, you know, all the way back to the Revolutionary War had ended up settling there. These English loyalists and soldiers after the Revolutionary War actually escaped into the Pine Barrens and were able to survive there, but they survived at the cost of the isolation. And so that in some case they came to a place where they didn't really understand the outsiders, and the outsiders had a hard time understanding them. This is the cost of isolation, of course, over a long period of time. But, you know, we were thinking about this. Pastor Darren and I were talking about the effects of the COVID-19 phenomenon that we've experienced, and really the long-term effects of isolation. It's one of the most lasting kind of places of damage that we are seeing, because people really do get affected. And it's not like, you know, now everything's, you know, you don't talk to each other for a few years and then you come back together and everything goes back to normal. No, there's some lasting damage that's done to people in breaking that kind of culture of speaking with others. That isolation has lasting damage. And we were talking about this, how this can not only affect people, but also kind of do lasting damage to communities when this isolation kind of takes its toll on people. So what we're going to do this morning is we're going to read a story from the early history of the Israelites in the Bible, when they had actually come into a great place. They had been given their land. They had received the promised land. They'd been come to a place of peace, and they were settling down. But they faced a real danger to their community, to the people of God, and it was because of isolation. So please stand if you would, and we're going to read Joshua chapter 22. Kimberly, would you read it for us?
Joshua 22, verses 1 to 34. At that time, Joshua summoned to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh and said to them, "You have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you and have obeyed my voice in all that I have commanded you. You have not forsaken your brothers these many days down to this day, but have been careful to keep the charge of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God has given rest to your brothers, as he promised them. Therefore, turn and go to your tents in the land where your possession lies, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of the Jordan. Only be careful, very careful, to observe the commandment that the law that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, to love the Lord your God, and to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments, and to cling to him, and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul. So Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now, to the one half of the tribe of Manasseh, Moses had given a possession in Bashan, but to the other half, Joshua had given a possession beside their brothers in the land west of the Jordan. And when Joshua sent them away to their homes and blessed them, he said to them, "Go back to your tents with much wealth and with very much livestock, with silver, gold, bronze, and iron, and with much clothing. Divide the spoil of your enemies with your brothers." So the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh returned home, parting from the people of Israel in Shiloh, which is at the land of Canaan, to go to the land of Gilead, their own land in which they had possessed themselves by command of the Lord through Moses. And when they came to the region of the Jordan that is in the land of Canaan, the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh built there an altar by the Jordan, an altar of imposing size. And the people of Israel heard it said, "Behold, the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh have built the altar at the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region about the Jordan, on the side that belongs to the people of Israel." And when the people of Israel heard it, the whole assembly of the people of Israel gathered at Shiloh to make war against them. Then the people of Israel sent to the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh in the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar the priest, and with him 10 chiefs, one from each of the tribal families of Israel, every one of them the head of a family among the clans of Israel. And they came to the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh in the land of Gilead, and they said to them, "Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what is this breach of faith that you have committed against the God of Israel in turning away this day from following the Lord by building yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against the Lord? Have we not had enough of the sin at Peor, from which even yet we have not yet cleansed ourselves, and for which there came a plague upon the congregation of the Lord, that you too must turn away this day from following the Lord? And if you too rebel against the Lord today, then tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. But now, if the land of your possession is unclean, pass over into the Lord's land where the Lord's tabernacle stands and take for yourselves a possession among us. Only do not rebel against the Lord or make us as rebels by building for yourselves an altar other than the altar of the Lord our God. Did not Achan and the son of Zerah break faith in matter of the devoted things, and wrath fell upon all the congregation of Israel, and he did not perish alone for his iniquity." Then the people of Reuben, the people of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh said in answer to the heads of the families of Israel, "The mighty one God, the Lord, the mighty one God, the Lord, he knows, and let Israel itself know. If it was in rebellion or in breach of faith against the Lord, do not spare us today for building an altar to turn away from following the Lord, or if we did so to offer burnt offerings or grain offerings or peace offerings on it. May the Lord himself take vengeance. No, but we did it from fear that in time to come your children might say to our children, 'What have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? For the Lord has made the Jordan a boundary between us and you, you people of Reuben and people of Gad. You have no portion in the Lord. So your children might make our children cease to worship the Lord.' Therefore, we said, 'Let us now build an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you and between our generations after us, that we do perform the service of the Lord in his presence with our burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings, so your children will not say to our children in the time to come, 'You have no portion in the Lord.' And we thought, if this should be said to us to our descendants in time to come, we should say, 'Behold, the copy of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, nor for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn away this day from following the Lord by building an altar for burnt offering, grain offering, or sacrifice other than the altar of the Lord our God that stands before his tabernacle. When Phinehas, the priest, and the chief of the congregation, the heads of the families of Israel who were with him, heard the words that the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the people of Manasseh spoke, it was good in their eyes. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the people of Manasseh, "Today we know that the Lord is in our midst, because you have not committed this breach of faith against the Lord. Now you have delivered the people of Israel from the hand of the Lord." Then Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, and the chiefs returned from the people of Reuben and the people of Gad and the land of Gilead to the land of Canaan, to the people of Israel, and brought back word to them. And the report was good in the eyes of the people of Israel. And the people of Israel blessed God and spoke no more of making war against them to destroy the land where the people of Reuben and the people of Gad were settled. The people of Reuben and the people of Gad called the altar witness. For they said, "It is a witness between us that the Lord is God." This is the word of the Lord.
Okay, we are reading in the near the end of the book of Joshua, near the end of the great campaign, the great time of taking the promised land. And it was after all of the land had been portioned to the different tribes, and it was a real great time of victory for God's people and a real time of unity. These tribes, the tribe of Gad and the tribe of Reuben, the half tribe of Manasseh, I guess you call them Manassehites, had helped their brethren. They'd come over from one side of the Jordan to help their brethren to take the land. It was a great show of unity. They had been very valiant, been very faithful. And so there was the whole kind of tribes were together. It was a beautiful time. They had a land, they had a place to be. It was terrific. But these two and a half tribes had now spent a long time away from their families. And so they were being dismissed now to go back over the Jordan and to reestablish their homes. But there was a problem with that, because there was an obstacle, we could say, to community. And that obstacle was the Jordan River. So here's a map that we can see, and you can kind of see the land of Israel. This is most of the land of Israel, and on your left-hand side to the west, there's the kind of land proper. But then there was this other land on the other side of the Jordan River that the two and a half tribes were given. And you can see it's not just a stream. You can kind of see something of the topography here. It's actually a great valley with a large river that runs from the Tiberias Sea or Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. It's actually a fault line, and it creates not only a geographical but a geological barrier from one to the other land to the other. And here's a view of it that I am giving you from the western side. If you're looking down, you see the river there running across the middle, and you see the great valley, the great Jordan River valley. And that shows you, when you were going on, it wasn't just, you know, the stream that you crossed. It was a whole different geographical area that you would be in if you crossed over the Jordan. It was a big obstacle. And they found, or were finding, that this was a real barrier to their community. And so these two and a half tribes made this altar of, as we heard, imposing size. It was this large altar in the same style, in imitation of the one that was over in the west. And it was built as a symbol of their common faith and their unity of worship. But this was a problem, right? And that was because God had bound the people to one altar. And that one altar was here in the land of Shiloh. Shiloh is I love Shiloh. It's one of the best places in Israel, I think, to go, because no one has come along and built a city on top of it. So it remains kind of in its natural state here, and here's a kind of view from it. And they've done excavations of Shiloh, and here's one, actually, an excavation from Iron Age I. So this is from the time of Samuel, not this period, but a time right after this period. It shows that there were buildings there. Because long before there was Jerusalem, long before there was Mount Gerizim even, there was Shiloh. And Shiloh was the place where God had put his presence, the place where people were supposed to come and worship. That's what bound them together. This is where the tabernacle was. And this is where the Ark of the Covenant would be. And this is actually the general area where the tabernacle would have been set up, that you can go and actually see. This is where it was, in Shiloh. Not there now, of course, but this was the one place where the presence of God was. And so you couldn't worship Yahweh, even if you said, well, I want to worship Yahweh and offer sacrifices someplace else. You couldn't do that, because that's not where his presence was. His presence was here in Shiloh. And so that was the problem. They all knew by this one altar that where they would make sacrifice, that were bound together, the people were bound together by a common sacrifice. All right? So the altar of Reuben that they set up really shows you how people could do something and it could look one way to one group of people and it could look completely different to another group of people, right? And they both could be really certain about what's going on. Like, they both looked at this altar and they saw two different things. And one group of people, they were sure this is what was going on. These people were apostatizing. But the tribes of Reuben and Gad and Manasseh were looking at it and saying, no, this is a sign of our unity, of our one worship together. And so you could be so certain about something, and yet it can be completely misconstrued, can't it? And so here we have, there's this large civil war that is narrowly averted between them. Hashtag, how quickly to war we go. And it was averted. Joshua 22 here shows us, though, how quickly we can get there, how quickly we can get to civil war with our brothers. And this is repeated among the people of God, even in the body of Christ today. I could tell you stories about whole churches that actually split. And you trace it back and you say, what was the problem? What was the difficulty? You trace it back a lot of times. You know, you're looking back at what it was, and it's hard to find. Like misunderstanding about the color of the carpet. This is what happens in churches sometimes. And you know, the Bible is very candid about these things. Doesn't cover them up or sweep them under the rug. It's out there in the open how quickly brothers can come to blows about this. In fact, after Joshua died, we just read about when Joshua was alive, but after Joshua died, there's a whole book about what happens next called the Book of Judges. When you read through the Book of Judges, what you find is these kinds of things that we just read about in Joshua chapter 22, they happen again, only this time the civil war is not averted. And the people start to have misunderstandings, start to have disagreements, they start to come to blows, and so you get to this judge, Jephthah, especially, who does things that actually cause disunity in the body, in God's people. And from there, it just spirals down until the end of the book of Judges, when it's basically a bloodbath, where you have the tribes that are just killing each other and decimating the numbers in the different tribes. It's just awful. And so that's what happens. But it didn't happen here. The reason why I wanted to read this with you this morning is because in Joshua 22, it doesn't happen. When Joshua is still alive, almost happens, it doesn't happen, right? So what makes the difference? That's what I wanted to look at with you this morning. I wanted to say, what made the difference? Why is it that these folks, even in the face of this isolation that was caused by the Jordan River Valley, why is it that they didn't come to all-out civil war? What are the lessons we can learn? I would like to look at this passage with you and draw out four lessons for us, four ways in which the people acted so that this didn't happen while Joshua was still living. Four ways, okay? So four things that keep civil war from happening in the people of God. Number one, it's going to seem kind of obvious, but there it is. They talk to each other. They talk to each other. Okay, if you look at verses 13 through 14, they get all ready. They're all worked up to fight. They all gather at Shiloh, and it takes a lot of preparations to get ready for war. So they're all gathering, getting ready for war. They're ready to go. But thankfully, before they fight, they send these ambassadors, including Phinehas, an important character, and they talk. And it all comes out in the passage, doesn't it? It's all a big misunderstanding. So what's the lesson? Pretty simple, as I said. Might seem obvious, but we need to talk to each other. People of God need to talk. When it's scary, you need to talk. When you have concerns and you're like, you really don't want to talk because, you know, you don't want, it might be upsetting, might cause difficulty. You don't want to talk. You need to talk. That's what they're doing here. They're talking. And, you know, this is the real damage of the lockdowns, I think, looking back. Real damage of lockdowns on church communities is that it destroyed the culture of talking. That's why some churches are not coming back. Some churches now, afterwards, their doors are closed. They're not going to open again because this culture of talking to each other was destroyed. And, you know, sometimes there is actual evil that goes on. And in this case, we're reading about a story where there was just really misunderstanding. But sometimes there's actual wrongs. But whether there's wrongs or scandals or misunderstandings, the solution is the same. Addressing it is the same. And that is you talk to each other. And there's a need to talk to each other. You know, there's a church nearby here that's going through a very tough time, because there are allegations of repeated instances of a leader in the church inappropriately touching different women in the church, acting differently, inappropriately toward women in the church. Now, this is upsetting, right? This is a very upsetting thing to hear. But what's worse is that when these issues were being raised, there's questions about how it was handled, about whether or not it was spoken of, whether it was talked about in the appropriate way. And thankfully now there's an investigation going on where this is being brought out into the open. And if you don't know, you know, the name of this church, you don't need to know. But I tell you, it brings up this good point. You know, here, we should know that kind of abuse is not tolerated at all, okay? At all here. I don't care who you are, you know, that kind of abuse of power is not something that we tolerate at all here. But for us to safeguard that trust with you, you need to talk to us. You need to be able to talk to us. If you have a concern like that or another kind of concern, you need to be able to talk to the leadership or the people involved. And if there's one leader you can't talk to, you talk to another leader here. By the way, there are two pastors here. You got it good. But we need to have you talk to us to do that. And we listen. You know, if you do bring concerns to us, we listen. We're obligated, actually, on paper to listen, but we want to listen as well for that to be safeguarded here. And, you know, it's not gossip. Some of you might be concerned. It's like, oh, I don't want to gossip. You know, if there's that great old definition of gossip. Gossip is sharing with somebody who's not part of the problem or not part of the solution. But we need to talk to those people who are involved, people who are the parties involved or to the leadership. Because if people don't talk, they can be misled. There's an assumption of evil sometimes where there isn't evil. You know, if we talk, we might just still disagree, but at least we avoid all-out war, all-out disintegration that goes on. So the people of God address scandal, they correct misunderstanding, they stave off war by talking to each other. That's lesson one that we see in this passage, number one. Lesson two, number two, they recounted their history to understand each other. You say in verse 17, what do they say? Phinehas is the one there, and he brings up this previous episode at Peor. And he says, I do not want to go back there. And this is probably why they sent Phinehas in the first place, because of this incident that he was involved in. He was like, do you remember Peor? Do you remember how bad that was? Do you remember we're still recovering from that? I do not want this to happen again. That's what Phinehas' concern is. And he's, what does he do? He's recounting the history with them. It's like, that was so bad. Don't you remember that? And then he goes back even further. You look at verse 20. Look at verse 20 there. It goes all the way back to Achan, the sin of Achan, which is the beginning of the book of Joshua. He says, you remember how bad that was? That was so awful. So he's remembering. He's telling them, that was really upsetting. It was really upsetting to me. This is our history. Don't you remember that? So you see, he's going back and recounting the history that they had together, what they had dealt with together. And that's an important point, to recount your history together. If you have to have a situation where you're bringing up concerns with someone, that's something that you want to do. To prepare yourself ahead of time, beforehand, you recount the history that you have together. Otherwise, when you start talking to people, you start talking as if you're strangers a lot of times. That's not good. So you recount the history that you have together, what you share in that way. And then, when you're talking to people, you want to recount that history as well. You say, don't you remember that time? Do you remember that time? Do you remember how bad that was? Or do you remember how good that was? So you're recounting that history together. So that's something that I see the people of God doing here in this time, subverting civil war. That's what I would recommend to us. That's number two. Number three, they shared concerns. See, you see that? The two and a half tribes end up agreeing with Phinehas and the elders in their concern. The elders bring up their concern, and what's the response? Well, this is, yeah, you know, we share that concern too about disunity, about breaking apart. In fact, that's exactly why we built this big altar, to actually stave off disunity in future generations. It's kind of ironic, isn't it? They built this altar for it to be a symbol of unity, the very thing that they're building to be a symbol of unity is in fact dividing them. That's very sad, it happens. It even happens in the church today, right? Just think of the symbol of baptism, right? Baptism is a symbol, a sign that was given us to unify us, and what is it? It ends up sadly dividing churches. So it's sad when it happens. That's what they're pointing out here. They're sharing their concerns. And you know, that means sharing concerns, not only like expressing your concerns, but trying to understand the concerns of the people to which you're talking. And that's a good thing to do. Sometimes you can appreciate someone's concern, even, you know, if you don't, still you might not agree, but you can appreciate their concerns, right? By the way, you know, I'm thinking you're probably sitting here saying, what's happening? Are we going through a church split here? Why is he giving us this sermon today, you know? No, that's not happening. Like some of you are thinking, I'm coming to this newcomers meetup today. What have I just stepped into, okay? Are we about to fall apart here? Why is he doing? No, I'm not thinking of anything big addressing here. This is what you call an ounce of prevention. Okay, this is me surveying the landscape post-COVID and offering you some advice to prevent these kinds of things that can happen in a body, in a church. So these are the three of the rules that you want to do. You want to share concerns. And when you do that, the real concerns, you end up talking about the real issues. Okay, fourth, fourth lesson here from this passage that I want us to hear, and that is humility. Humility ends wars. Really does. You know, you look at verses 21 through 29, what do we see there? The Transjordan tribes respond. And what you don't see is them answering proudly. Okay, so they get this accusation that you guys are turning away from the Lord and what you're doing, right? And how do they respond? They don't answer proudly, and so the situation is not escalated. So what you don't hear the Transjordan tribe saying back to them is, how dare you? How dare you accuse us of turning away from the Lord? We have been so faithful. We came across and fought with you. We came across and we're so valiant. Where do you get off telling us that we're going off? Man, who are you? That's what you don't see. It's what you do see later in the book of Judges. Actually, you see exactly that. It's people like, how dare you accuse us? And that's the tendency in a situation, right? It's like, you know, hey, I'm trying to follow the Lord. I'm trying to do what's good. How dare you, you know, say there's something wrong with what I'm doing? Don't see that. It's the absence of pride, right? And then in the response to the response in verses 30 through 32, you see that in verse 30 through 32, the response to the response is also humble. Because when they realize that, oh, these people built this altar for a different reason, then that means that the elders and Phinehas, they have to go back to all the people of Israel gathered at Shiloh. They have to go back and say to them, never mind. Mind. I mean, it's a big thing. I know we've got ourselves worked up. I know that you've prepared for war. I know you've all come together. You've got all ready for this, but, you know, never mind. It wasn't what we thought. That's a humble response that they have to give, the response to the response. And that's what they do. And so what happens after that? Nothing. You know, they do a DTR moment, and then they go home. Right? Determine the relationship, and then they go home. See what they don't say, and this is what would be the tendency in that situation, the elders and Phinehas. We know that Phinehas can follow through with things when he needs to. But would be the tendency in that situation to say, you know, there's this misunderstanding, but I'm so worked up. There must be something here. Like, you know, I'm so angry. I'm so angry. It can't just be nothing. Otherwise, I wouldn't be so angry. So I'm so angry. There's got to be something here. So let's look for something else to be angry. Let's look for something else to fight about. That's what we do, do we not? Can I hear an amen somewhere? That's the way it goes. Thank you, sister. But that's the way I am, right? I got myself so worked up already. There must be something here. It can't just be a nothing misunderstanding. That's what you don't see. So you see the pride on both sides, not there. And so civil war is averted. And this is what's is needed here. There was a pursuit of humility on both sides. You know, David Pallison, in his writings, he draws out how difficult it was for England during World War II, later in the war, because they had to work with Russia. You know, interesting. I'm not trying to draw any lessons for what's happening currently, but you know, in the beginning of World War II, if you remember, Russia was actually allied with Germany, and Joseph Stalin was cooperating with Hitler. In fact, supplying oil. Russia was supplying oil to Germany and iron to Germany for the war. And that went on until Hitler, as he did, betrayed Stalin and then invaded Russia, right? And then all of a sudden, Russia flipped in World War II. And now, before they were fighting England, now all of a sudden they're allies with England. It's very strange. But what had to happen to defeat Hitler, and there was one thing they had to do, they had to stop Hitler. To defeat Hitler, England and Russia had to work together closely. That meant Winston Churchill had to work with Stalin. And Powelson brings out how from Churchill's diaries that Stalin was this grasping, manipulative, bullying character. It was actually really difficult to work with him because whenever they would get together, he was always suspicious. He was rarely grateful for anything that Churchill was doing. It was just an awful person to work with, Stalin. The reason why the war came to an end is because Churchill stayed in there and humbled himself for the sake of Europe, for the sake of actually the whole world. He humbled himself and stayed in there so they could work together to provide both fronts on either side of Germany. And, you know, United States certainly made a contribution, but this is what ended the war, is that they were able to cooperate, work together on both sides, creating a front on both sides to defeat Germany. So you see what happened there. Humility brought the war to an end. And that's the way it goes. Humility will end a war. So where does that come from? You know, these types of responses that we get from the folks in this chapter, in chapter 22, where does that come from? Especially that last one, humility, that's needed. Well, if you look at verse 34, it tells you the altar that they made was called witness. They called the altar, verse 34, witness. Witness that the Lord is God. So they brought this common sacrifice, this idea. We have a common sacrifice between us. We have a common redemption that helped them to remember all 12 tribes, the Trans-Jordan tribes and the West of Jordan tribes, they all came from the same place. And they all had the same sacrifice. That was supposed to be the witness of this great altar that they built. We've all come from the same place, and we all need the same sacrifice. Well, you know, things really haven't changed in the body of Christ. We also have that symbol, only we have a much more powerful symbol that says exactly the same thing, and that is the symbol of the cross. Because we cannot look at the cross together coming from either side of the Jordan without seeing that we all come from the same place. What does the cross of Jesus Christ tell us? It tells us we both come from the same place. That is, we both come from the need to be freed. We both come from the need to be brought out of our sin into redemption. Both of us, all of us. And that's what brings us together. That's what allows us to stay together and avert civil war. We both come from the same place and we both share the same sacrifice. And that sacrifice is the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for us. Right? And this is the thing, friends, this is the thing that bonds people together more than anything else in the entire world. This is what does it. It is this common rescue. That is what allows people to really be unified. It's like, you know, when people are rescued from a plane crash, right, or a boat accident, you know, and you have those stories where people are there's this amazing rescue and people who are on a boat together, they didn't know each other, or they were rescued from a plane together. Remember that? And then what happens to those people? It's like they end up getting together and barbecuing every year, right? And you read these stories, they have them on the news. And these people form bonds that they come together every year and celebrate. And sometimes those bonds are stronger even than the bonds with their own family. Why? Because they went through this rescue together. They were rescued together. It bound them together. This is what binds us together. It's the common rescue of Jesus Christ. It's something that eventually will do away with all divisiveness in the world, because this is the thing that can bond people together, and it's what can bond us together. The cross is our rescue. And when that happens, when we are united, you know what it means? It means the Lord is here. Look at verse 31. When they are reunited, what does Phinehas say? Phinehas says, quote, today we know that the Lord is in our midst, unquote. This is how we know that the Lord is in our midst. And you think of what happened. Well, what about all the other things the Lord had done? That he had given them the land, that he had given them all this bounty, that they had peace, they had a place in the world. But now Phinehas says, today we know that the Lord is in our midst. Why? Because there's unity among the brethren. Phinehas is right. There is nothing that shows that God is in our midst like a unified people. And this is what the cross does for us. So that's what we're going to do now, friends. If you would, please rise with me as we celebrate this symbol that has the power to avert civil war and to bring us together, to bond us together in this common rescue. Let's look to him now. The Lord be with you. Lift up your hearts. Let us give thanks to the Lord our God. It is right, Almighty God, to give you thanks, to give you praise, because you have made a way for us. You have made us one. You have been in our midst whenever we are able to respond in the ways that we see in Joshua 22. We know that you are in our midst and you have made us one. And we thank you for that hope, Lord, when there is, as Ryan was bringing out, such hopelessness in the world, such breakdown, such disunity, such war all around. We thank you for giving that hope because we see at times that you do bind us together. We thank you for that. And because of that, we lift our voices now. And we praise you with all those who've gone before us, including these people that we've read about in the book of Joshua who are with you now. We join our voices with them in your unending hymn of praise. Word.